I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of one woman's struggle with censors at the CIA to search out details of her own father's death. Charlotte Dennett's dad worked as a spy for the CIA back in the 40s. He died in a mysterious plane crash when Charlotte herself was all of 6 weeks old. But when Charlotte grew up, she decided to find out not only who her father was, but what he was doing and the circumstances of his death. She's certain that he played a role in the post-war battle for control of Middle Eastern oil reserves. But even 61 years after her father's death, the CIA is very cagey about releasing information. Charlotte talks about the thick black lines drawn through her father's own papers.
He was talking about Saudi Arabia and that we occupy a dominant position in, and then it's redacted. And I knew that had to be Kingdom of Saudi Arabia because that's the only place we have.
The hunt for Dan Dennett's past and the secrecy that still surrounds U.S. Middle Eastern oil policy. That's right after the news. The CIA finds itself under renewed scrutiny today. Lawyers and judges in Denmark and Spain have announced their push for proof that the CIA violated international law by directing secret flights through their countries. They suspect these flights were used to transport alleged terrorists prisoned at Guantanamo Bay. They might take a lesson from my guest today. Charlotte Dennett's father was a high-level spy for the CIA. He was based in the Middle East. He was killed in a mysterious plane crash in 1947. The New York Times story of that date told of Ethiopian runners bringing news of the crash from the desolate mountains between Asmara and Addis Ababa, a place it described as one of Africa's loneliest spots. Well, 61 years later, Charlotte is still pressing the CIA for details about the crash and her father's work. Her own story has led her all the way to the Supreme Court.
It's a fight for democracy. That's really how I see it. And I'm just one tiny player.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Charlotte's father was Daniel Dennett Jr. He was one of six Americans killed in 1947 when their military plane crashed in the mountains of Ethiopia. At the time, Charlotte was just a baby. She doesn't even remember her dad, but her own career took her into journalism and travels through the Middle East. One day, she decided it was time to dig into her own story and all those unanswered questions about her father's death.
I knew that there was a steamer trunk, but I'd never really taken a careful look. So this one day, I did go up into the attic, and I opened the steamer trunk. And you know that feeling you get when you go into the attic? It's sort of creepy, your stomach's sort of turning into knots. I mean, that's the way I feel when I go into an attic.
Yeah, but that's where treasures live, you know? There's an excitement about going up there, too.
There is. There's just history all over. So I opened up that steamer trunk, and I found four scrapbooks. And I pulled them out, and oh, my goodness, it was amazing because there were two scrapbooks of letters home. There was a scrapbook filled of pictures from Beirut when he was serving there as cultural attaché, and that would be 43 to 47. And in those scrapbooks, the most valuable to me, of course, were the letters home. These were letters that were written by my father and my mother back to his parents who were in Winchester. And probably about a six-page report that was what my mother had written on the top, Dan's last letter home. And there was also Dan's last report. And I read them very carefully, and that's when I felt I really should find out more.
Do you have any of them with you there?
I do. I have my father's last letter home, dated March 10th, 1947.
So written just 10 days before his plane went down.
That's right. He was the only government official on this very special trip to Saudi Arabia, and the purpose of it was to tour all of these new American oil installations in Saudi Arabia. And he goes into great length describing what it was like to be there. It's a little American compound, really, in the middle of the desert, and it's got all the appropriate American amenities, and he talks about that, how you can have steak and bird's eye peas and apple pie. And
well, read us a passage so we can hear his voice.
Aramco has to a large measure taken over the function of a legation or a government. The king doesn't bother with our minister but deals with the company. The company provides the king and his people with food, trucks, automobiles, airplanes, and all sorts of supplies to enable him to feed the people. And he goes on and describes this extraordinary relationship between an American company and the king. And I think that the reason why he was brought along on this trip as the only government person is because they were trying to figure out how to send the oil from Saudi Arabia to some place on the Mediterranean coast where it would be then transshipped to Europe. So when I read that, I knew that my father was in the middle of something big.
The timing is intriguing. This is right after the Second World War. And at this time, no one really knows how much oil there is in countries like Saudi Arabia. But the race is on to secure supplies, a race that goes beyond the Americans and the Soviets, the French, the British, everyone's in the game. I asked Charlotte to tell me what she knew about her father when she was growing up.
I always knew that my father was a spy, even though I never knew him. Obviously, from the time that I was thinking rationally, my mother had let me know that my father was a spy. But beyond that, I knew nothing.
And you never pressed your mother for details? Like, what kind of a spy was he? You know, what did he do? What's the story behind him?
I didn't. And I think the reason I didn't is because I didn't want to upset her. I was afraid it would bring back so many aching memories for her. I didn't want to see her cry. And she didn't talk about him a great deal. I think in retrospect now, I have a feeling that she was being protective of her three children. But I won't know, and I'll never know, because she died when I was around 22. So all those questions I wish I'd asked her, I couldn't ask her.
What the New York Times reported back in late March 1947 was that a U.S. Army C-47 transport plane crashed in a mountainous, desolate area of Ethiopia on Thursday, killing its six American occupants. And down in the news story, it says, known to have been on board Daniel C. Dennett Jr. of Newton, Mass., American cultural attaché at Beirut, Lebanon, and then further down mentions the fact that he leaves three children behind. Your brother would have been about five, I guess, your sister eight, and you just a baby.
That's right.
What kind of stories did people tell about your father? I mean, how did you form a picture of this man? Because I can't imagine you wouldn't want to try and somehow color in that missing part of your life.
I was always being regaled by funny stories about my father. He had a tremendous sense of humor. He played Romeo to my mother and climbed up a ladder to her bedroom.
This is before they were married or after they were married?
I think it was after they were married. I don't know, he was quoting from Shakespeare or something, and his pants fell down in the process of being up on the ladder. Everybody thought that was hilarious. I don't know why that's the one story that stays in my mind. You know, he liked to party, he liked to have a good time, but there was a very serious side to the man. I knew that he had specialized in Islamic studies at Harvard, and there weren't very many experts in those days. He spoke fluent Arabic. He had a great love for people and cultures, and that's why he was cultural attaché. I mean, that much I knew.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. When Charlotte Dennett set out to discover who her dad really was, she could never have anticipated where her search would take her, and that one day she'd be suing the federal government to find out. But I'm getting ahead of myself. She knew that her dad was in the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. That's one of the precursors of the CIA. Charlotte had found her father's letters.
When I first stumbled on these, and this would have been, say, 1975, around then, it was just the beginning, and look at me now. I mean, I'm still searching.
I would have thought that, given the fact that what we're talking about happened 60 years ago, you could pretty well put your hands on any information that would, you know, flesh out what had happened. Isn't there a system of declassifying documents 30 years after the fact?
Well, yes. One of the things that I ended up doing was going to the National Archives.
So did you find your father? Was there a Dennett file there that you could get your...
The first thing we found was a book, an official history of the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, which had been written by Kermit Roosevelt. And it was actually my husband who found the book.
The book had been classified and it had been declassified?
It had been declassified. And so he started going through it. And there was a section on the Middle East. And there in that section, it mentioned that the top man who'd been posted to Beirut had gone by this code name called Carrot, C-A-R-A-T, like the jewel. and that he was very highly regarded and that a lot of his reports went directly to Washington. So both of us could figure out just by the dates they described that he'd been posted there and the area where he was working that that had to be my father. So that was the first thing.
And this was the first time you'd ever heard that your father's code name was Carrot.
That's right.
Charlotte says she was able to piece together a lot of the detail from that time using the files that had been declassified. But she says her father's work, and perhaps his death, were all wound up in the chase to secure oil supplies. And that was a story unfolding by the minute in the years right after the war.
The frustrating part for me is that everything stops at the end of December 1946. And my father died 3 months later. So the information that I want most, which was what was going on immediately preceding his death, I only have little pieces of.
And what's the rule? How does this work with freedom of information? I mean, because it was 60 years ago, do you have a right to that?
I have a right to it, except they can always deem certain documents continuously classified because they don't want to reveal sources and methods or for national security reasons.
So what do you do? Do you send in a Freedom of Information request to the CIA saying, I want everything that's got my dad's name on it?
You can do a Freedom of Information request within the National Archives. They have specialists there, and that's where I started. I had found three boxes of my father's reports, and a lot of them had withdrawal slips. So I asked that these documents that had been withdrawn be declassified. And in many cases, they were. It took a long time, but they were. But there were some documents that they weren't about to release to me. And the other thing is those last 3 months, I couldn't get into 1947. There were tremendous delays, which was very frustrating to me. And I finally did get 300 pages released by the CIA. There was a few gems, but mostly they weren't anywhere near as interesting and detailed as the actual documents that were in the archives. But I was still faced with the fact that I didn't have the last 3 months. So that's when I filed suit in February 2005. And sure enough, that's the only way you're going to get them to take you really seriously.
So the bottom line is they have stuff. You know they have it. What are they saying? That they won't give it to you because it's still covered by national security? Or are they saying
that's
that
right.
They don't? Oh, okay.
That's it. That's as simple as that.
You remember that news story from a few weeks back when the CIA admitted it had destroyed videotapes of its interrogations at Guantanamo Bay? Charlotte Dennett was paying attention, thinking that perhaps the files on her own father's spy work back in the 40s might not even exist anymore. But Charlotte did some investigation of her own, and we'll talk about what she dug up in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Today's tale is one of international intrigue. An American spy killed in a mysterious plane crash back in the 40s. His daughter begins with family letters and news clippings from that time in her own search for details. Charlotte Dennett referred me to one newspaper story from 1947, one that she says helps sketch in the story behind the story. It tells of the French and the Dutch and the British and the Russians and Americans all zeroing in on Iran and Saudi Arabia. I'll read a bit here. It says, optimists among oil men consider that Iran or Arabia may become a bigger producer of oil within our lifetime than either the United States or the Soviet Union. Look, here's the thing. Back then, they thought there might be 5 billion barrels of oil beneath the desert. We now know that's closer to 300 billion barrels of oil. No wonder the place was crawling with investors and diplomats and spies. So anyway, Charlotte Dennett's father was a spy with the CIA. She's following these leads in the National Archives, but she's also searching out old contacts. One of them is Sherm Russell, her father's closest friend.
And when I went and talked to him and said, what do you think about this plane crash and what happened to my father? He started out by saying that my father was the top man in the Middle East and that he said, my father... Dan, as he called him, Dan would never lie to me. And he knew that he was in a very high position.
This fellow you were talking to, Charlotte, was he also a spy?
No.
But
he was just
a close friend of your father, so he would have...
He grew up with him in Winchester, Massachusetts. We interviewed him several times, and the first time he was telling us about how important my father was. He told a little anecdote about... Now, here's a nice anecdote about my father. He said that he took my father out one day to a shooting range, and my father sort of feigned ignorance, and Sherm, you know, set him up and taught him how to shoot and then gave the pistol to my father, and my father just hit the bullseye every time. And I mean that, you know, because he was trained. And I guess Sherm liked telling that story. But
did he know anything? Was he able to tell you that, you know, your father lived a life on the edge, that he was at some risk? Was he able to shed any light on the secret side of his life?
I think my father confessed some things to him, but he didn't tell me what they were, other than that what he was doing was very dangerous and that my father had hoped that if anything had happened to him, that Sherm would look after our family, which he did. Hmm. He was our closest family friend. When it got down to asking him about the plane crash, he said, oh, yes, he said, it was sabotage. I said, you're kidding, because no one talked about this in my family. My mother certainly never told me this. And he said that the plane had been shot down. And when I tried to press for details, I couldn't get it. And I said, well, then you think, you know, this was sabotage. He said, yes. I said, well, who do you think was responsible? And he said, oh, yes, this is one thing that my father said. My father had said that he thought the Russians were on to him. So Sherm told me, he said, you know, since your father told me that, that could have been who it was. When I dug deeper and I started going through declassified documents, I found out that, that, as my father described it in one of his reports, there was a huge, quote, free-for-all in the Middle East after the war.
Charlotte Dennett used Freedom of Information requests at the National Archives to help get information. And she wasn't getting much. Years went by. But then she got lucky.
Yes. I found the accident report. That day, I will never forget. Because at that point, I'm, you know, consciously looking. Whereas the trip to the attic and stumbling on those scrapbooks was sort of mild curiosity. By the time I found that accident report, I was, of course, intensely interested.
In
so
full gallop
all these beautiful,
for this story.
Yeah. Beautiful, glossy pictures of the crash, many different shots of the plane.
What did you see, though? Because the newspaper report that came out a couple of days after the crash said the plane was completely wrecked.
It was completely wrecked, but you could see the crashed wings. You could see the tail. You could see the hold. Other than that, it's just strewn all over near a little town called Desi. And there's a picture of villagers transporting the bodies on muleback to the nearest town. So it was way out in the middle of nowhere.
So your father's body was actually recovered and brought back to the U.S.?
No. The obituary says that his body was returned to Beirut. When I started getting into some of the declassified documents, I found out that the bodies were taken to, I believe it was Morocco of all places, where they were cremated. So I think maybe his ashes were returned to Beirut, but they did find the bodies.
Charlotte, what was in the accident report about the cause of the accident? Was there anything there?
Yeah, there was. They did a very thorough examination, and they were really mystified. And when I say they, the people who did the report, they were very confused because the pilots were excellent, known to be excellent pilots, and had flown this route before. So it wasn't like unknown terrain. The weather was clear at the time of takeoff, and the plane crashed only about, I think, 10 or 15 minutes after takeoff from Asmara in Eritrea. So they had absolutely clear visibility, and yet the cover story that was first, I think it was a cover story that was first put out, was that they thought maybe bad weather had caused the accident.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Charlotte Dennett used personal interviews and the National Archives and her own family papers in the search for details about her father's death. And when Charlotte was being stonewalled by the CIA, she sued them to get more information, and she did get a few key papers.
This one document, which I call the jewel, it's heavily redacted. I mean, there are huge pages just blacked out. And this was written in 1943, before my father even went to the Middle East.
Why do you call it a jewel? What's in it?
Oh, he's repeating what he's obviously been indoctrinated in. This is what you're going to do when you go over there. This is the information we want you to find out. This is the situation that exists. So he's sort of...
These were his marching orders that you were reading.
These were his marching orders, and he's repeating them. So...
Give me an example of something that's in there that caught your eye.
All right, here's something that originally had been crossed out, and after I filed suit, they sent me another version of this document. They removed some of the redactions. Here's an example. It's well recognized, I'm quoting here, that up to 1939, a deliberate effort was made by all great powers, Axis and Allied, to undermine our prestige. Now, originally, all great powers, Axis and Allied, had been blacked out. Okay. Now, what does this say? This is confirmation of what I have discovered in the process of learning about my father. There is this great game that's going on. I call it the great game for oil because there's no more heated competition among great powers than to control the oil. Another line in this document that, for me, was very valuable. He was talking about Saudi Arabia and that we occupy a dominant position in, and then it's redacted. And I knew that had to be Kingdom of Saudi Arabia because that's the only place we have a dominant position. And then the next line says, the probable extent of these oil deposits is so great that we must control them at all costs. That's very important because that still exists today, and much as, for instance, this current administration is trying to deny that the war in Iraq is about oil, it is most definitely about oil. And my own research has shown that the great game for oil has been going on for centuries. So it's subterranean. The only way you can really find out about it is by looking at pipelines. And interestingly enough, the New York Times has done a fantastic job. Every once in a while, they'll do a story about pipelines and who's trying to run a line through whose territory. And once you get a handle on that, you realize that it's laden with political and geopolitical implications. So this, for me, was a lovely confirmation of what I was already finding out through all those documents that I'd gotten in the National Archives. And it's interesting because, you know, Valerie Plame, who by the way, sued the CIA, you know who she is.
Yes, but indeed.
And she had discovered the same thing, that the current CIA had redacted whole sections of her book, and she thought it was ridiculous anyone could find this information. And in fact, someone had written a whole appendix and had figured out what had been redacted. So why is the CIA currently blacking out information? In my case, it's 60 years old. In many cases, you can find it elsewhere. You just have to dig and dig and dig. And the only thing I can think of is that they're just trying to discourage us. They're just trying to show that, you know, we might as well be wasting our time trying to get this information. And yet, we have a right to it. That the freedom of information is very crucial to an American democracy.
Charlotte Dennett knew that her father was working for the CIA when his plane crashed in 1947. And her attempt to get information about his work eventually attracted the attention of a New York Times reporter. He wrote a short story, and that brought reaction from many different quarters.
I had former OSS people contact me.
People who knew your dad?
Not that knew my dad. One person was a pilot who knew the pilot of the plane. Another person had a relative, let's put it that way, and knew about the tremendous secrecy about the American oil finds in Saudi Arabia. I thought everybody knew about the great finds when Americans struck oil. And this person thought maybe the plane crash would have something to do with, you know, my father knew too much. It probably was about the route of the pipeline that was such a serious situation. You know, which country was it going to terminate in? And
Charlotte, when I listen to you kind of parse this, I come back to something that I said earlier. It sounds like you figured most of this out anyway. I mean, what is it that the CIA could fill in for you that you haven't already figured out on your own?
The ultimate satisfaction would be to know for sure if the plane was sabotaged, and if so, who done it? It's as simple as that. It's a very basic human need to know. There are all sorts of indications that it was sabotage one way or the other. I'm not sure it was shot down.
Yeah.
But I want to know. You know, I had been warned way long ago that it's very hard to get judges to second guess the CIA. They're very reluctant to do that.
It's funny, too. I bet if you tried to do this, you know, in 1995 or at any time before September 11th, you probably have had a lot easier time trying to get this information.
I believe that is so. And when I first filed an appeal, which was, as it turns out, the day after September 11th, and I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, you know, when am I ever going to hear from them? And yes, in today's climate of secrecy and national security, it's a fight for democracy. That's really how I see it. And I'm just one tiny player in that. But there are many people. It's a very beautiful thing.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. If you go to our website, you'll see that we have a list there of all the other men who were on that aircraft in 1947 with Charlotte Dennett's father. They were from Beverly Hills and Boise, from Oregon and Iowa and New York. We have a list of their names and their ranks at thestory.org. Charlotte met one man who proved to be invaluable, a researcher for a book on double agents who'd come across some of her dad's papers.
He had found these boxes of reports by my father, and there was a bombing in the embassy, for instance. It's probably one of the first bombings in the Middle East that happened in 1946, and there was a bomb that was put in the British embassy and a much bigger one in the American embassy, and his job was to figure out who did it.
This was
and
in Beirut, right? Sorts, where he
this
lived.
This was in Beirut.
Yeah.
It was in Beirut, yeah. And so he did four different reports of exploring, investigating who could have been behind it. And as he describes it, he said that, frankly, that he thought that the British thought the Jews had done it because the King David Hotel had just been blown up previous to that. And these were, you know, Zionists who mm-hmm. were fighting against British control of Palestine. And the King David Hotel had housed a lot of British intelligence officers. So the British thought that's who'd done it. And my father disagreed, as did some of his cohorts, because it was a really sloppy job. It just wasn't very professional, and he ultimately concluded that it was Arab nationalists that had done it, who were very upset about, well, a number of things, but among others, they were threatening to hit American oil installations next.
So trying to figure out who's setting bombs in Beirut, that sounds like not much has changed in this world.
Nothing. Indeed. And so that has really made me look at any incident that happens in the Middle East, including, of course, in Lebanon,
yeah.
which it's still going on. You know, if my father were there today, he'd be looking at every single different foreign power and its the people that it uses to think of who would have had the motivation to do
yeah.
this. Yeah. It's never what it seems to be. That's the whole point.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Charlotte Dennett notes that her next and likely final deadline for her appealing her search to the U.S. Supreme Court has a kind of odd familiarity.
My deadline is March 20th, 2008, which happens to be 61 years from the date that my father's plane crashed.
Do you ever get the feeling, Charlotte, that he's watching?
Well, funny that you should ask that one, too. I had a sense of a presence when I was a reporter, had ended up going over there when I was in my 20s, and I felt like I was retracing many of his footsteps. I've had many, many coincidences on this long quest, and so sometimes, who knows?
I mean, do you ever just sort of say to yourself, I'm working on this, Dad, just give me some time?
As a matter of fact, I feel like I have to do this for his memory. And because of all the coincidences, sometimes I think, who knows? I just have a feeling that I'm on a path and that it's the right thing to do.
if you get nothing, Charlotte, nothing more than you've got after years of work on it already, are you okay knowing what you know right now? I mean, you've covered a lot of ground. You've really taken that sketch of your father and added a lot of color and depth to it.
I am okay in the sense that I've got an in-depth understanding of the beginnings of American involvement in the Middle East. I may never know ultimately what happened, but I've learned so much along the way, and I think it's information that's important. I think it's information I need to share. And so in that sense, the whole quest has been immensely satisfying, and I do know more about my father, and I have found little anecdotes, even written among fellow spies about him. It's like a jigsaw puzzle, and a lot more has been filled in, and it's gratifying.
Yeah, it is a fascinating story. Charlotte, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Charlotte Dennett is a journalist and a lawyer. She lives in Vermont. She asked that I share with you the names of the other people who were on board that doomed plane along with her father, and the names are on our website at thestory.org. So if you happen to be a relative or a friend, and you might be able to help Charlotte, we'll help you get in touch with her. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Oftentimes, you'll note that stories we hear loop back and bring us different perspectives on the news. Here's one that connects a tale of pre-war Britain with a childhood in Nigeria and the primary election that's underway today. Perhaps you were listening last week when we brought you a conversation I'd had with Harry Bernstein. He's a 97-year-old author who told me about growing up Jewish in an English mill town on a street where Jews and Christians lived on opposite sides. Christian kids would shout insults at Harry, but he and his friends would never retaliate, at least not directly.
We were really afraid of them, basically. We would not have done what they did, not all of them, but some of them in their drunken moments particularly. But we did certain things that expressed our feelings, such as when we passed a church, we spat.
Harry says it was like growing up on a street with an invisible wall down the middle. Adewale Adewumi heard that program and contacted me because what he heard got him thinking about his own experiences with race and ethnicity and politics.
The divide between the Jewish community and the Christian community, I experienced the same thing, or similar rather. I saw that in the country where I grew up in, or where I came from, in Nigeria, there was that invisible wall that exists there as well between people. And it's not just among ethnic minorities or ethnic groups, but even within each subgroup, there is still that invisible wall.
Adewale works as a pastor on the Palm Coast in Florida. Now, he's been living in the United States now for 30 years, and the divisions he heard in Harry's story are still familiar to him. He sees evidence of that invisible wall right in his own church.
I see it every day between people of different races or color. I have had one member in the past, several years ago, to leave the congregation, leave the parish, because I was too, according to him, too accommodating of other races. We had a recovery group, that is an Alcoholic Anonymous kind of group. This kind of group brought together people from all races. And this one person vocalized his disdain for, if I can use his own language, said, "We don't want all these white people using our church." I was hurt by that. I was offended. And as the chief administrator of the congregation, I had to rebuke that kind of bigotry. But being that this an older person couldn't live with it, he made up his mind that he would leave the congregation, and he did. That's what I have observed, and I've been involved in trying to eradicate that kind of behavior. But old ways, people who are set in old ways, it's hard to change them.
And this is what brings us to today's primary voting. You see, the word change is one that we hear a lot in politics these days. It's a theme that captures Adewale Adewumi's attention. You see, he thinks of change in very personal terms, and he puts it in a very personal story. Adewale went home to Nigeria in 1987, over 20 years ago. And he left because he criticized the military regime there, so his homecoming was fraught with worry that it might not be safe. Even so, it was a joyful reunion.
People were very glad to see me back, even though all of us had grown older. But they were all glad to see me, and I was happy to see them. And also, I soaked in the hospitality of my people that I had overlooked or forgotten about. There I was, feeling sorry for them, but they would go to the compound or to the yard, grab a goat or grab a chicken and slaughter it and go to the market and buy stuff and just entertain me, refusing to let me even feel sorry for them. So it was a very good time.
Was it hard for you to leave, though?
Yes. My last day, my bag was packed and all, and it's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, my half-brother came to pick me up, and we got in the car, well, in a taxi, actually, and we started to leave and, of course, exchanged greetings with my mother and my aunt and all the neighbors and the children everywhere. Well, I left, and we drove about 2 or 3 blocks. I remembered that I left something on the coffee table in the living room, so I turned around, and we went back home. But to my shock, I saw my aunt and my mother leaning on the gate of the compound, looking in the distance. They didn't even realize that my taxi was the one approaching them. Their eyes were bloodshot. They were crying. But I had never seen my mother in tears. But then they were happy to see me back, and so I spent another about 20 minutes just I found what I was looking for. I left it on the coffee table. My parents, or the adults rather, wished me well and say a word of prayer, sent greetings to my wife, to my children, to my co-workers, to everybody. You know, they took time to mention each one. And so it took another 15 minutes to finally leave. And so I got back in the taxi, would turn around and head toward the airport. But I also got very teary-eyed. I mean, my tears was just flowing. I just could not shake that picture of them being in tears at my departure. I couldn't shake it off my mind. I was like a child leaving home for the first time. But the irony of it was that I never even thought that that would be the last time I would see my mother. That's the last picture of her that I saw.
Adewale, was there a time when you changed your mind and began to think more of the U.S. as home?
It happened in June 1990 when I received the news. Of course, I received the letter 2 weeks later that my mother had passed on. It was not an easy thing. But at that moment, after I recovered from the initial mourning period, at that time, I lost, it felt like I lost the magnet that made me want to go back to Nigeria.
Yeah.
I felt the loss so deeply because I never thought of my mother dying. It was like she would be immortal.
The interesting thing is that at that time you were married to an American woman. You had 2 children born here, both American daughters.
Yes.
And you had not yet taken out American citizenship.
No, I had not.
When did you say, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to take out American citizenship?
Only in May of 2007. There was a presidential election in Nigeria in April 2007. And the whole world and all the observers who were there from the European Union and other countries, even Jimmy Carter, they all said that election was nothing but a charade. There was no election. It was all rigged. I just lost the last hope that I had of returning to Nigeria. I lost it. So I decided that it's time for me to take American citizenship. The reason for that was that, I mean, why I had waited so long was that I always wanted to go back to Nigeria, run for office, and do something. Friends had been telling me to take American citizenship since about 5 years ago, and I kept saying, yes, I would, yes, I would. But after that election of April 2007, I decided that that was not the place for me anymore. I will go there and visit my family for that reason, yes. But as for political or being involved in the administration or anything in Nigeria, I lost that hope.
So the decision to apply for American citizenship, was it, were you thinking also at the time that once you have that, you can take part in politics in this country, you can vote here?
Exactly. That's what finally did it. I said, now I need to vote where I live. Jesse Jackson years ago said to students at Bethune-Cookman College in Daytona Beach, he said, home is where you spent the last two nights.
Well, it would have been for him. Poor fellow was on the road. Still is on the road all the time.
Yeah. So I took that seriously to say, wait a minute, I've lived in the United States for 30 years, so I need to participate in political activities here.
Tell me something, though. As we get ready for this particular election, and I'll speak only about the Democratic Party here, I mean, we're now looking at the prospect of a candidate who will either be the first African-American candidate or the first woman candidate to represent that party in the election. When you hold that up against the corrupt nature of the election that so discouraged you in Nigeria, what's that comparison like for you?
Things are much, much better in the United States. In the electoral system here, everything is done according to laid out principles. I don't see anyone changing the rules overnight.
Somebody would quarrel with you about what happened in 2000, but I think that the comparison between the Chads in Florida and what we saw in Lagos in Nigeria is not, they're not really comparable. You probably
agree with that. They're not comparable because the hanging chads and the dimpled ballots, at least they were still held up to scrutiny. They were examined whether they were valid ballots or not.
Yeah.
What happened in Nigeria in April 2007 was nothing to be compared to that. In fact, ballot papers were taken to the homes of politicians and filled out and fingerprinted and counted as valid vote. To me, that is corruption to the highest order.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. My guest is Adewale Adewumi. He is a pastor on the Palm Coast in Florida. And as you heard him telling me, he's originally from Nigeria. And the corruption in elections there inspired him to become an American citizen. So after 30 years living in the U.S., he can finally vote here. I asked Adewale if he ever used his position as a pastor to encourage his congregation to vote.
Yes, I have. I saw in my home people who lost their lives trying to vote, and that my people here should not take the election or voting. They shouldn't take it for granted, that it's a privilege that must be used regardless of the outcome of any election. Participation in the electoral process is very important. Even looking at American history, the activities of the civil rights movement. In Mims, Florida, Harry T. Moore and his wife Harriet, who were bombed on Christmas Eve in 1951, all because Harry T. Moore was encouraging people to register to vote. So I use those experiences to tell people that the privilege of voting today had not been presented to African Americans on a silver platter, that they should take advantage of it and vote.
Yeah, and we started out by talking about your observation that that kind of racial and ethnic tension that you grew up with and that you see in your own congregation is still a part of this country. Do you see something possibly happening in this election? Do you see something different about the choice between a woman and an African-American candidate that has in some way caught your attention or galvanized you to a level of involvement that's new?
The choice between African-American and a woman is a tough one. But the main thing is that either one, the time has come for either one, either a woman or an African-American to occupy the White House. Now, from the pulpit, I do not endorse any specific candidate. And I make it very clear when I express personal opinion. Now, among the congregation and in the community, because the church is located in the predominantly African-American community, I see a zeal and enthusiasm among people that I had not seen in years, actually since the first Clinton election. Mm-hmm. People are, they're enthused about the election and they want to participate, and the turnout that I saw on January 29, Tuesday in Florida was encouraging, that people are taking this one seriously.
What's at stake here, though? I mean, when you made the decision to kind of release some of the roots that you have in Nigeria, that was a big deal for you. Do you think that the election that's ahead has that same kind of transformative possibility for this country?
I believe so. I believe the time has come to show that America has come away from the racial divisiveness of the past. This election has a chance of rewriting history and rewriting it in a way that is more uniting or unifying than dividing one against the other.
One more question, Pastor. I know you have two girls who are both of voting age.
Yes.
How caught up in the election are you finding them? Are they twisting your arm?
They are both enthused about the candidates, and they are registered, and they will cast their votes. But I always tell them to vote for a candidate of their choice. But I can say that at least I've heard from my younger one, who is so gung-ho about Barack Obama.
And so, your older daughter, what's she thinking?
We haven't had an in-depth discussion. But one thing about both of them is that they vote for a candidate who will uphold and continue the values that they have been brought up to appreciate. So they will have to both look at both candidates, all the candidates.
Adewale Adewumi is a pastor on the Palm Coast in Florida. Now, he got in touch with me because he had a story to tell, and you can do exactly the same thing. In fact, we rely on you. Yes, you, to help us tell America's unfolding story. It is your story. You can get in touch with me at thestory.org. I hope you can join me tomorrow. My guest will be Kwaku Ture, like millions right now. Kwaku is watching the political landscape shift. He had his own chance to see that kind of change. It was the early 1990s. Kwaku was out of work, and he stumbled into the office of Reverend Jesse Jackson. He started stuffing envelopes as a volunteer. The next thing he knew, he was asked by Reverend Jackson to accompany him on a flight to New York. Kwaku couldn't believe it.
He placed me in the seat beside him, and he fell asleep. That's when I just kept staring at him and seeing if it was real. And I couldn't believe it, that I was there holding his satchel, him taking me to New York on a trip. And when we arrive, we get into this limousine, and lo and behold, Percy Sutton and Bill Cosby and Lou Rawls were the next people I met. I mean, I couldn't describe it.
Kwaku Ture is my guest on The Story tomorrow. Political power, political change, where does it really happen? With the heavy hitters or down at the grassroots level? If you have a story you'd like to contribute, I would love to hear from you. The fastest way to get to me is through our website at thestory.org, or you can leave me a message on our telephone at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.